It's been a disaster for 19 years, nothing being done. It's just been heartbreaking that you got to spend all his time in jail talking to someone on a phone or trying to make a way to go see him.
That's Kenya Williams. She's talking about her brother, Corey Williams, currently incarcerated at Angola Prison in Louisiana. Back in 1998, at just 16 years old, Corey was sentenced to death for the murder of Jarvis Griffin, a pizza delivery man in Shreveport, Louisiana. Corey was found guilty despite a lack of physical evidence against him and a profound intellectual disability. Well, because of that disability and the fact that he was just 16 at the time of the crime, Corey is no longer eligible for the death penalty, but he's still behind bars serving a life sentence. His legal team has made several appeals over the years, and this time they're hoping to take their case to the U.S. Supreme Court on the grounds that Corey's confession and conviction just weren't reliable. His story is the subject of this week's Case in Point from Andrew Cohen at the Marshall Project.
Even before this episode, Corey Williams sort of had a reputation as being the fall guy, the chump, as the court later put it, where the adults in his life, the teenagers in his life sort of blamed him for things that he didn't do. And they did that, of course, because of his intellectual disability. So he's hanging out with a group of adults one evening in Shreveport. The pizza delivery man shows up to deliver pizzas and becomes the victim of not just a robbery, but a murder. Someone shoots him, kills him, takes the pizzas, takes the money, and flees the scene. Corey Williams is present at this event and is petrified by it and runs to his grandmother's house and tries to hide by putting a sheet over his body as he lies on a couch. That gives you a sense of his, I think, intellectual capability at the time, thinks that that's going to save him as he flees from this scene. And that's where essentially the police come in.
The police come in and they arrest Corey Williams. What was his questioning like? This is a crime he ultimately confessed to.
Yeah, well, the police don't arrest him right away. The police want to talk to him, and he says the adults around him commit the crime. He says also to the police at this time, early on, that these adults that were at the scene of the crime at the time told him, Williams, that if he were to snitch on them, that they would get back at him. And the police believe Corey Williams initially. They believe him because all of this other evidence points away from him as the perpetrator of this crime. But nevertheless, they bring him in for an interrogation. They keep him an entire night in police custody, if you will. And at a certain point, they begin to make suggestive questions towards him. And he says, yes, I did it. And by the way, can I go home now and go to sleep? So they have this confession, we'll call it, that they later use primarily as a way to get both a murder conviction against him and also, for a while anyway, the death penalty.
What was his trial like?
The trial was based on that so-called confession and on the testimony of another man who was at the scene of the crime. And the story here is so shocking because all of the other evidence pointed away from Corey Williams. There were two brothers who were involved in this and a third man. The murder weapon was found near the house of one of the men. The victim's blood was found on the clothing of one of the other people. There was a fingerprint found that wasn't Corey Williams that belonged to one of these other folks. So you have all this physical evidence linking away from Corey Williams, and yet police and prosecutors chose for some unexplained reason to go after Corey Williams. And they went after him based on the confession that I think most people would consider a false one, and also on the testimony of the one witness who may have been involved in the crime, but who was never charged for it.
Did Corey Williams have an adequate defense here? I mean, what happened in front of the jury when his defense lawyers were pointing away, the evidence points away, and making that clear? I assume they made it clear.
They did, and I don't think this is one of those cases where you can point to the defense and say this was an atrocious defense. The trial was dominated, right, by the so-called confession and by prosecutors relying on the summaries of witness statements that they said incriminated Williams and basically failed to incriminate these other people. The defense at the trial was saying, wait a minute, it's these other guys who did it, jurors. You should consider that. But the defense wasn't able to present its best defense because the transcript of these interviews with these people were summarized by police and prosecutors in a way that basically changed their meaning. So the police were talking to these men, and these men were saying, well, Corey Williams couldn't have done it. I think it may have been my brother who did it. and other incriminating statements were made by witnesses. Those statements went away in the summaries, and instead the summaries made it seem as though these people were incriminating Williams. And of course, the jurors were only able to deal with the summaries and not the actual transcripts of the interviews.
Right, but Andrew, how does that work in Louisiana? Why are the people who want a conviction, and that's their job to get a conviction, prosecutors and the police, allowed to edit to make summaries for evidence that gets submitted in court? Why don't jurors see a full transcript of what a witness has to say?
Yeah, it's a great question. And the use of these summaries is not exclusive to Louisiana, although I think Louisiana prosecutors have turned this into an art form. If you have a prosecutor who's going to play fair in a particular case, right, the summary is going to accurately reflect what it's summarizing. And the idea behind that is that sometimes interrogations are hours and hours long, and you want to basically cut to the chase, and you want to be able to save time at a trial, for example. But the critical component of that is that the summary is accurate. And what happened here is that not only were the summaries misleading, they were actually wrong. They completely reversed the sort of sense of incrimination that was such a key factor in the case. And they came from a parish, Cato Parish, that is known, or was then anyway known, as being one of the death penalty capitals in the country, led by a prosecutor who later was found to have engaged in his own misconduct. So there's a lot of constellations of issues here that I think the justices are going to be interested in once they begin to pay attention to the case.
Andrew Cohen, senior editor at the Marshall Project. Andrew, great to have you, as always.
Glad to be here.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.